so as we mentioned in the introduction, this will be like a slightly different episode to our usual one, because not only do we have more guests, but also because of the time that we have, I wanted to sort of maximize the amount of time that we have with our esteemed guest. Before I go into like the sort of preamble of the sort of context of all this, I wanted to introduce the three members of Fossil Free Books. If you want to introduce yourselves.
My name is Mohamed Tunsi. I'm an Egyptian author based in Edinburgh.
And I'm Jessica Gaitan Johannesson, and I'm an author and bookseller based in Edinburgh as well.
And I'm Guy Ginnaratne. I'm a novelist and playwright. I flip between London, UK, and De Malmö in Sweden.
Cool. Well, thank you guys so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. As the sort of bit of scene setting for people who are kind of unaware of what's sort of going on, in the UK, we're having a handful of sunny days, which means that, and as a result, there's been a furore over this cancellation of literary festivals across the country. This is largely because a large sponsor, an investment fund called Baillie Gifford, announced that they would pull out of sponsoring several festivals, citing external pressures. And it led to some of Britain's columnists and cultural commentators, many of whom participate in the festival circuit, to decry the group called Fossil Free Books. This group encompasses workers across the literary industry, authors, publishers, librarians, cover designers, and more. In the words of Jessica and also Andres Odorica, the two authors in Fossil Free Books, we organize as equals without internal hierarchy, without funding, and alongside work and other commitments. We are the workforce that literary festivals rely on, and we love sharing our work with our readers. Many of us are based in Scotland and act out of love for its literary spaces. We believe that literary festivals and events that do not rely on the profits of human rights abuses or the destruction of life are possible. I think that's probably a good way to sort of start. And I wanted to ask you guys, before I have my own questions for you, could you tell people who haven't, who sort of aren't familiar with what's been going on, number one, what is Fossil Free Books? How did you start? What is the sort of like, you know, what were the reasons sort of behind it? And could you also explain a bit more about kind of what's going on in terms of the news coverage, and in particularly the sort of controversies over the literary festivals, and why Fossil Free Books has sort of appeared in mainstream outlets with quite a lot of what we will sort of learn soon to be like fairly unfair critique.
So I can maybe start with just talking about what Fossil Free Books is, and then hand over to one of my fellow members to take over from there. So Fossil Free Books is a collective of book workers. And what we mean by that is that we are the people that create books and that work within the industry that sells and trades in books. That is the book industry. So we are authors, but we are also booksellers. We are illustrators, translators, people who work in the publishing industry, all sorts of people that make the book industry possible. We are called Fossil Free Books because we want an industry that is not funded by money that is invested in the fossil fuel industry. So that is, and that was the main kind of drive behind starting Fossil Free Books. However, we also don't see, as a lot of people justly do in the climate justice space, we don't see divestment from fossil fuel investment as an isolated issue. It's tied into all kinds of issues around human rights abuses and around the effects of colonialism, such as the attacks on Gaza in Palestine and the occupation of Palestine. So after the 7th of October, and with the attacks on civilians in Gaza, we also started organizing around this, because it turned out that Baillie Gifford, the sponsor of then the Edinburgh International Book Festival, which was around how the festival around which we started, also has significant investments in companies that have links to Israeli apartheid, occupation, and genocide. So for us, those two issues are intrinsically linked. Environmental harm and violence has been a strategy of the Israeli occupation forever, really. And we also believe that cross-issue organizing is how we build alliances, and it is how we build power and how we can change things. Does anyone else want to take over from there in terms of what's happened? I didn't actually talk about how we started. Guy, maybe you could talk a little bit about how we started.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I can talk about it from my perspective. A group of us had come together, I think, in response to the Ferret article that came out last summer. That was at the time sort of much publicized because Greta Thunberg, in response to that, pulled out of the Edinburgh Book Festival last year. In response to Greta's pulling out and the, and that article being distributed and sort of disseminated amongst writers who were going to be attending the festival that year, we came together and created a statement of opposition to Baillie Gifford's investments in sort of fossil fuel extraction. And that letter was signed by over 200 signatories at the time, including many well-known writers and authors who were either in attendance or were really well-known in the industry. And because of that, I think the response was incredibly intense. But from my perspective, in those weeks leading up to the festival, as that core group grew and grew and grew into a wonderful sort of collective and coalition, a lot of trust, I suppose, was built up, and a lot of care between each other. We sort of decided what was comfortable for each of us and how we personally felt able to act, whether it be speaking and sort of reading statements before our events at Edinburgh or other kinds of actions. And people come and go, right? So members have since then sort of been more vocally part of the group and have had to go away because of, you know, other issues like childcare and things like that. But the formation was very much around wanting to have a collective voice in opposition to the kinds of things that Jess articulated at the beginning.
Yeah, I think that's like sort of a good introduction, and I'll ask you like more about how the group is structured in a second. But what I also will, because like I think people, a lot of people will sort of have come across fossil free books more recently because of the sort of ongoing sort of debate, for whatever you want to call it, about the literary festival. It's like something that I'm interested in partly as like someone who has published a book and has sort of done a few literary festivals, and kind of, you know, the idea of them and like the reality of them, I think, are very different. But one of the sort of like critiques of the sort of Baillie Gifford exit and, you know, your group among certain members of the commentary, I'm not mentioning anyone in specific terms, but the general kind of argument is that like this is going to sort of unfairly target literary festivals that are necessary for authors, are necessary for writers, and so on, which I think is like an interesting statement to make on the basis of that. In a lot of ways, it sort of exposes the real precarity of people who sort of make and produce and like distribute books, as you sort of mentioned. But there is some sort of something bigger here, which is seemingly a refusal to engage with like what the sort of role of like these types of investment firms, not just Baillie Gifford, but indeed like you know, recently, like, you know, Barclays, for example, but the role of these sort of big corporates in terms of sponsoring arts events. And I wondered whether you could talk about that a bit more, just in terms of what the literary festival like perhaps kind of represents in sort of the broader context of like British or even like Western publishing, but also like why would like these big corporates be interested in the art world like anyway?
I think definitely literary institutions like book festivals, they provide authors and especially debut authors with a massive platform to publicize their work, to discuss their work, and open it up to a lot of new audiences. And it's obviously kind of like a very important part of the books industry, because that's where publishers also get quite a bit of sales. That's where authors get a bit more recognition. And I guess this is where kind of like asset managers like Baillie Gifford also do come in, because they see the potential for kind of like associating themselves with this sort of creative labor that people do Prize quite a bit in the UK as kind of like an important meeting of great minds and all of that. So they want to have that association kind of like with those literary festivals, which is why they would go about sponsoring them. And I think kind of like an important thing to note is that the backlash from Baillie Gifford dropping their sponsorship of literary festivals is also very much because that that form of that way of advertising themselves has actually just really worked well, because they've associated themselves as kind of like great patrons of the arts and the creative industries, that people have been actively kind of like coming to defend them rather than listening to the authors that have been platformed at these festivals and kind of like listening to their demands for change.
Yeah, what I would add to that is just, you know, one of the things that this campaign has shown, I think, is how unsustainable and precarious the model had become. Because we're coming in after 14 years of austerity policies that have completely decimated the arts, so, and made them reliant on private financiers that can just pull out at any moment. And this is exactly what's happened. So I think it's become clear to a lot of people in a way that it really wasn't before, that this isn't a sustainable model. You know, as workers in an industry, we need to be able to scrutinize where that money comes from and just ask questions. And that's exactly what we did. We asked questions, and Baillie Gifford would not tolerate that. They would not engage in a conversation about divesting from specific companies with links to human rights abuses. Instead of doing that, they decided to move away from the sector, from the book festivals entirely. So you could very well ask the question, you know, how much did they actually care about the arts and about book festivals in the first place?
It's also important to note that the wealth is there to actually kind of like spread amongst books festivals. It is just kind of like very much consolidated in very small spheres, where really big advances are given to kind of like really big name authors. So the money is there to actually support the book festivals. It is just kind of like not really spread around where it needs to be as well. Like if bigger decision makers and kind of like bigger entities within the books industry actually do want to support these festivals and kind of like really see the value in them, they would also kind of like step up.
I wondered whether you could talk a little bit about the structure of Fossil Free Books, because as you mentioned on your website, like, this isn't just like a group for authors, it's like for everyone sort of involved in the kind of construction, distribution the construction and distribution and the marketing of books. But also you kind of mentioned that, you know, there is like no hierarchy. It's not really an activist organization. And I wondered whether you could sort of explain or like kind of give some insight into like how this group is structured and how it's organized. And if, for example, like anyone who works in the books industry who listens to this show, and there are a few who do, are interested in kind of like being part of it, how would they do that and what would that look like?
So I can pick up on what you said about, you know, not being an activist organization. I suppose that differentiation will be phrased a bit differently by different people. To me, there is a difference between activism and organizing. And we tend to use the word organizer within Fossil Free Books for a reason. And that is because we're not doing this just to raise awareness, and we're not doing it as a form of like volunteering or charity. We're not an NGO. We're doing it for our own industry. So we are organizing our own industry to change our working conditions, and that is a big difference. I also think that there's an element of acceptance for activists in the publishing industry if it makes money. So there is a kind of commodification of authors / activists in the industry, where it's absolutely fine to talk about social justice issues on a stage or in your book. But as soon as you start questioning the publishing industry or the book industry itself, then you run into trouble. Mm. So that, I think that's important to point out, because there is a difference there, and it's at the very foundation of how we work as Fossil Free Books. So if you come to one of our weekly meetings, for example, we read our manifesto and we kind of lay out our basic agreements that we have and that everyone agrees to when you join a meeting, that we, regardless of whether you have, what position you may have in your role, whether you're like a really famous author or you have a higher position in a publishing company or in a bookshow, whatever, within Fossil Free Books, everyone has equal say and an equal position, and everyone is listened to. So that's at the very, very core of it, I would say.
I think one of the points that you made that I sort of really want to know more about, especially for people, especially like, you know, for people who are like much more inside of the industry than I am, is how have you guys seen the industry sort of change in such a way that it has become so external, or so reliant on external capital rather? So you obviously, like, one of the kind of answers to this is the sort of effects of austerity and the ways in which that has kind of, like, the decimation of the arts has sort of given some organizations either the choice of kind of like quitting or shutting down altogether, or sort of being reliant on, or like trying to find other ways of like raising money to sort of continue to do what they do. But I wondered whether, like, there are other forces as well that have made, like, publishing and working on books, whether, like, you're writing them, whether you're marketing them, to be a lot more difficult. And, like, how, like, in the past kind of, like, 10, 15 years, how have you seen that change in such a way where, like, these types of investment funds, big banks, and so on, like, are seen by other people within the industry to be so essential that any type of resistance towards them should be thwarted, even if, like, because I think one of the things I was really surprised about was when I was reading some of the columns, was like this awareness that, you know, big capital, like, you know, capital, big corporations and stuff, being completely aware of art washing and the way in which creatives are often, you know, used to like sanitize the kind of like excesses and the sort of negative externalities of these types of industries. But there is this, like, there seems to be the sense of, like, well, we don't really know what else to do, especially because if there's no hope that, like, any future government, including like an incoming Labour government, have any real plans to sort of like invest in the arts in a significant way, then is the only way to sort of sustain them, or is the only way to sort of sustain that type of creative work a reliance on these kind of external forces of capital? And so I wondered, like, I guess, like, to put it simply, in your view, what has happened in the past, like, couple of decades to make this kind of settlement so ingrained that, like, there are many authors and publishers and stuff who just can't imagine what publishing might look like without these types of external sources of capital?
I can answer those questions. I think it's a really important question. I think these are sort of questions we're all articulating for ourselves, because it pervades all areas. I mean, clearly, broadly speaking, the industry-wide change. But also, I mean, I think it really impacts how an author, any artist, kind of sees themselves in relation to the industry they're working in. To my mind, it comes really down to how neoliberalism as a sort of political economic doctrine has both so successfully been naturalized. Because I think it really comes down to how it reorientates how we see each other and our engagement with art and art making into sort of this market orientation. So we have artists who dress themselves as entrepreneurial artists. It reframes our relationships with one another as sort of competitors. Competitors in a deeply unequal economic field. And it shifts our approach to art in ways it sort of aligns really with value as extrinsic, so sales figures and that kind of thing. I mean, I've lost count of how many times I've sort of spoken with young writers in particular in how they see success and how they value it. And it seems, and it deeply concerns me, because
Go ahead. Well, all I was going to ask, and I don't know whether you were sort of heading towards this, but I was going to ask, like, how has that also affected the way in which writers who, like, people who sort of create stuff, like, has the sort of way in which the industry has changed, like, has that also changed, like, the expectations that writers, like, put on themselves, or even just, like, you know, the idea of, like, what publishers actually want? Like, how is it also, how has it changed, like, what is being kind of submitted and, like, what's being published?
Well, I mean, if writers are moved to act, it's to sort of at least attempt to ask for a better context within which to present their work. But also I think that that context, which is, you know, a neoliberal frame, it does change the artistic subject too. So, I mean, you, as I say, you have sort of an entrepreneurial artist that creates sort of book-shaped objects to put into a books market, which is then shifted onto a books festival. And it's only a depoliticized subject in that it becomes an asset for that single sort of worldview or a political context. It's a false image. Which is, I mean, for me, it's always been a perversion of what art and labor look like, really. And I'm sure Mohammed and Jess can talk on this, but I mean, that focus on extrinsic value, value allotted to a book in a market, it opposes that any policy guided by the principle of art as having intrinsic value, things like shared memory, you know, the civic sense or captivation, you know, or aesthetic growth. That's something I think if fossil free books has done anything is simply to call attention and scrutinize that system, especially in terms of arts washing and the laundering of artistic reputations and labor. Because the context currently, to my mind, doesn't do anything but deny the intrinsic value of art.
Can I just add to that briefly? Because we've talked about this quite a lot, and I mean, this self-image that so many in the book industry currently have, it's almost as if it's very contradictory in a way, because art is supposed to have an intrinsic value, hence we aren't supposed to see ourselves as book workers or be part of an or as part of an industry or something that actually creates profit or creates value or is sold. But at the same time, you know, we're not that somehow is supposed to depoliticize us or puts us, give us less power, if that makes sense. So it's both a really degrading way of looking at art and a highly elitist way of looking at art, or it's at least it's elitist on the surface, I think, but actually really degrading.
Yeah, and I would just add to that the problem of kind of like the fact that the publishing industry is very much consolidated between a few big publishers that doesn't leave much of a market share to smaller indie publishers. Because at least in my experience, having worked with an indie publisher, it is very much the case that you get a sense of what labor is put into actually making a book, creating it and putting it out into the world. It is not this kind of like disconnected and kind of like distance thing, which I feel like, as a guy pointed out as well, is kind of like an effect of neoliberalism, is that there's a disconnect between the work that you're creating and the actual kind of like output. And a huge part of that as well with regards to a huge part of like what we try to do, I think, with fossil free books is to also create a structure that can actually represent us. Because obviously, kind of like within these spheres, we don't really have much of a union that we can actually rely on, especially because Society of Authors kind of like has shown itself to kind of like not be representative of its membership and not kind of like actually want to advocate for it rather than properly kind of like advocate for the rights of its authors. It has chosen to actively kind of like knock them down and also kind of like endanger them, which is kind of like what we found with the Palestine Solidarity Motion that we tried to put across.
Yeah. I was wondering whether you could, because I think one of the things that I found really interesting about your group is just like sort of encompassing, like, I think the idea of sort of conceptualizing, or at least like the reality of kind of the production of a book as a sort of form of labor, which is like, it feels like such an obvious kind of point, but I think you're completely right in the sense of like how, like detached lots of, you know, how detached lots of people from the industry are from each other, that it can like feel like that's not the case. And the reason why I brought that up is because some of the criticism or some of the articles like that, and Guy, you wrote a piece in Tribune like addressing Howard Jacobson, which we'll sort of talk to talk about in a second. But one of the sort of kind of arguments that Jacobson seems to be making is the idea that like authors shouldn't be political, or they like, or they should sort of separate kind of like their politics from the type of the art that they're creating. And I think this is a point that's also echoed by Marina Hyde on a podcast whose name I can't remember. And I think that sort of really gets to the heart of like one of those issues, which is, I think Guy, as you mentioned, and I'd love to you to talk some more about this, because as you mentioned in your Tribune piece, which we'll link to in the show notes, this has never really been the case. Like writers have always been political. They operate within a political context. Like they've often been, even the ones who sort of have complained about it have been sort of overt in their politics. But nevertheless, this idea that like the author is kind of someone kind of creating a product for cultural consumption, and those, and the people who can consume it, especially at literary festivals, are those who like can afford to, you know, afford tickets to buy them. Because, you know, I imagine like people who have been to literary festivals will know, like, it is pretty expensive to go as a visitor to one of these festivals. And so the idea of like the book is sort of this kind of thing that should just be kind of consumed and considered to be apolitical, or sort of only aesthetically political, is something that has nevertheless seemingly permeated into kind of literary spaces where you'd think that authors would sort of know a little bit better. And I wondered whether you could talk about your Tribune piece and also the ways in which, like, I think just like to interrogate this idea where and where it came from, that like authors should not kind of express politics, and like to do so is to almost like remove the enjoyment out of it from, you know, people who are just like going out for a weekend to the literary. Because like the argument that seems to be made is that the sort of the threat to literary festivals, be it real or imagined, is like kind of, you know, the people that are really being hurt here are like people who sort of save up money to go to them, which is obviously not the case. But nevertheless, I wondered whether you could sort of expand on that kind of critique some more, and just generally this idea and where it came from of like the author as a sort of non-political producer of a cultural good.
Well, I mean, for me, it's deeply disingenuous to suggest an artist must and can only be considered an artist as long as they shut up and play along with whatever system or industry they support and are a part of. And it was really quite extraordinary for me to watch the supposed backlash, and in particular where the commentary came from. Some writers, but I mean, a lot of it for me speaks to, I think, what all of us are quite conscious of when we are invited and speak at these festivals, but also, you know, other conferences and spaces that are incredibly insulated. And one of the things I think that is heartening, at least from being among a group of writers who deeply care this much about the spaces in which we're invited to, is that how we relate to each other is so antithetical to how we are presented in this sort of individuated framing at festivals, etc., is that the effect of that renegotiation amongst ourselves, that we are not competitors and we are not in it for ourselves, and we are sort of together as workers, and that sort of reframing ourselves as workers generates a sense of power and a self, an affirmation of what we are and who we are. And to be quite firm about it, from my perspective, I'm speaking for myself, at least here, is that the commentariat, so celebrity columnists and podcasters, excuse me, saying present company excluded, politicos, don't get to really dictate where the location of culture is in this country. I mean, it seems bizarre to me that the commentary around this is to sort of speak about these spaces and as if they're sort of garden utopias where the dialogue and discussion flourish. When my experience, and I think the experience of many writers, is that conversation, because of the corporatism around those kinds of event spaces, really in actual fact, contains those conversations rather than lets them flourish. They diffuse them of any potentiality. So that when, and so, you know, they, many of the commentary like the language of action and change as long as they're metaphors. and so that when a group of us do take action and act on that potential, there is a sudden seizing and territorializing of ground. But I think the feeling of from within Fossil Free Books amongst us is that, well, you do not make culture. That is not cultural ground. They don't produce culture. They don't produce art. We do. And it is the novelists and playwrights and poets who are boycotting here. So what are we really talking about when we're talking about the spaces within which and the context within which we represent our work and who is getting to speak? That to me was the astonishing thing. But it only really took 5 minutes within a Fossil Free Books meeting to realize, no, this is what action and change really does look like. It's difficult. But affirming that sense of our own power as culture producers, as book workers, as writers, taking hold of that and using that as a way to demand what we need, I think, is an important thing.
I think that might be a good point as well to just say something about the Scottish context potentially, which is quite particular. And both Mohammed and I are based in Edinburgh, we've been part of these actions since we started last year, and it's been very interesting is a very non-committal word to describe this. But so for those who don't know, so Bailey Gifford is a Scottish investment manager, and not only does it until recently did it sponsor 10 literary festivals across the UK, but it has a particular presence in Scotland. It sponsors art galleries, for example, and that means that there are very long-standing relationships between different kinds of leadership and the art leaderships in the art world in Scotland and this company. Now, for us as authors who live in Scotland and have lived here for a long time, and have been part of these spaces and have colleagues and have networks, it's been really kind of just discombobulating to see how these narratives of what constitutes the literary Scottish landscape have been sort of pulled out, and not least, you know, immediately they go down a kind of like racist route, to be honest. Like there have been comments about, oh, they're not Scottish enough, essentially, because surprise, surprise, we do have quite a lot of authors of color in our in our collective. And, you know, this also points towards what kind of literary establishment were these festivals protecting all along, and how inclusive were they, you know, to put it bluntly? Because for the best of intentions, they've been spending years and years and years trying to become more quote unquote diverse, and still rely on those big names and aren't really all that bold in terms of inviting new voices and underrepresented voices. So I think what we're seeing now is not only a backlash to the idea of book festivals as being, you know, noble, wonderful places, but also a backlash to the whole questioning of the whole power structure and who gets to say, no, actually, we are also part of the Scottish literary landscape and we are a Scottish literary community.
I just wanted to echo all of what Jessica said there. Especially because it does feel that recently, kind of with everything that's been happening, the fact that people of color and writers of color have been used as essentially kind of like optics for the book festival and for those spaces has also kind of like become much more apparent, because as soon as we bring the conversations that we're already having kind of like to a point where we do demand some sort of action and some sort of change, the feedback was just, yeah, very damaging and very negative, and essentially kind of tried to split us up into kind of like these camps of us versus them, which is just such a falsity. And it essentially was a way for them to try and diminish and dismiss us. And it was at that point that kind of like I bring it back to a previous thing that Jessica had also pointed out, which is them signifying us as activists rather than writers. At that point, they anonymized us, even though it is a small literary community in Edinburgh. It's like everyone knows everyone. And we were on those stages a year ago speaking as organizers on behalf of Fossil Free Books, and have communicated with them kind of like under that name since then. Mm. So they know us as writers and as people. We're not these just anonymous individuals. But their social clout was very much kind of like weaponized against us by kind of like them deeming us as kind of like just these anonymous people.
Mm. Yeah, and I think it's a kind of very telling tactic. And it's sort of interesting to kind of look at like that oscillation between sort of being referred to, I guess like Guy puts it well, in terms of like how your work, like the context of which your work is presented and who gets to sort of determine what that space looks like. But the oscillation between kind of presenting, you know, 1 year, like, you know, these are sort of authors, prize winning authors, like people, authors who are sort of even presented as being kind of like the voice of, you know, of the new British generation, to then just sort of being dismissed as kind of, you know, activists and being dismissed as kind of people, you know, there was another column that was written, which sort of argued that what Fossil Free Books was doing was really making this kind of overt political statement that was designed to undermine the incoming Starmer administration, obviously, you know, the incoming Starmer government, which I thought was like really, really bizarre. But nevertheless, is like, you know, there's a line in that column which is very telling. I think it was by Danny Finkelstein, who sort of writes that like, oh no, what they're actually trying to do is like undermine capitalism, and you know, having failed like the core, you know, having failed like, you know, with Jeremy Corbyn now out of the Labour Party, like, you know, the next target is going to be these cultural institutions. Like, it's a really bizarre and like very strange statement to make, but is nevertheless very telling in terms of like how you can sort of be like minimized and how you can be diminished despite being kind of like, being sort of like, you know, not that long ago, like a respected creator in that sort of creative field. And it did make me wonder about like, you know, whether you guys had any thoughts on, you know, how that type of time, like how, I wonder how much of that is kind of the ability to sort of like take even the act of working away, and whether that contributes to the idea, you know, of, you know, books and the creation of books not being a form of labor. Because it feels like that kind of is that sort of seems to be the kind of cognitive gap. And I wondered just as like, even just in terms of general thoughts, and I'm trying to articulate this as I speak, because again, it's like really hard to even conceptualize this, but like, do you find, is it a struggle like to actually kind of convince the general, like the public or the media, that the creation of a book, the creation of like fiction is an act, is a sort of like an act of labor? And why is that? I guess I sort of put it simply, it does feel like some of what's driving some of the criticism comes out of this idea that actually producing a book is like a luxury. It's like an indulgence, and therefore, because it's not like, because it isn't work, like it should not be sort of subject to kind of political action. And it feels like your group is sort of saying, not only is the creation of books a form, you know, book work is a real thing, and like the creation of it is a form of work, but also within that there is a political context and there is like an economic context, and obviously they sort of feed into each other. So I guess to put it simply, I wondered whether like you had any thoughts on how do you sort of convince, or how are you sort of working to convince a public, if you are doing that, like that the creation of any type of cultural product is a form of work, and therefore like should sort of be considered within the context, like should be considered within like a labor context. I don't know if that makes sense. I'm sorry if it doesn't.
I was thinking about this recently, and I thought of Sara Ahmed's book, Queer Phenomenology, because that book essentially starts out with Sorry, Ahmed, kind of like ruminating on a metaphor that's often used of kind of the philosopher sitting at an empty desk and kind of like essentially kind of like operating with a clean slate. And yeah, and from there, kind of like the brilliance and kind of like all of the theories just start emerging. And I feel like the book festivals and the literary landscape still kind of like operates with that metaphor in mind to a great extent, that it does kind of like operate out of nothingness. But as sort of Ahmed kind of like points out, there is labor to actually kind of like keep that space clean and to kind of like prepare it for that work as well. And essentially kind of like all we did was point that out. With regards to the difficulty of convincing authors that kind of like their labor is also, yeah, their that their work is labor. I don't know. I'll leave it to someone else. Sorry, I rambled.
No. It was really helpful.
I think maybe some of it, or a large part of it as well, is just to do with, it's a very convenient, or it's convenient for private institutions that the book industry just operates with individualism, so that the book industry markets the individual, right? Because that is at the very, very core of neoliberalism, as Guy was saying before. And so when we then come together and work as a collective, that presents all of these kind of confusions to people. It's almost like, it was almost like the industry didn't know how to deal with it. I felt that, like, what, you know, what, you're a group, but you don't have any like faces that are like leaders or like people that call themselves founders, or no, we're all just members of this collective, which doesn't mean that we're anonymous. We're still saying, hey, I'm a member of this collective, but there is no there's no marketing of the individual, which is very, very different. And I think, which also goes back to neoliberalism, there's a rule by dividing there, right? If you have the different parts of the industry and the different people that go into that, whose labor contributes to a book being made and sold, if they do not talk to each other or aren't actually allowed to feel any connection to each other, then they are so much easier to basically exploit. And there's such basic things with all industries, but I just don't think that that has been really considered on a wide scale when it comes to the book industry, because we're meant to do it out of the kindness of our hearts and our like our convictions and in some sort of romantic sense, you know. But I do think that that can be a powerful argument to make to people, because if you say to people, you know, the average author makes 6K a year from their writing according to Society of Authors, then people are like, okay, well, what other jobs do people have, and how do you actually manage your finances? And then you kind of start feeling like there's a collective here of people contributing to an industry, and we could all maybe benefit from talking to each other and feeling like we actually belong to, we have a sense of belonging.
To throw light on real in the world relations between each other, I think it's almost a responsibility of any worker or any member of any community. But even, I mean, it's also just telling, even the words we use to describe this and describe the system. Neoliberalism is such a politically freighted term. I remember hearing a professor at Goldsmiths sort of point out that the proponents of neoliberalism never never use that term themselves. So if you ever hear the word neoliberalism, it's always in criticism. And the aim is to have the policies be so pervasive as to make them sound like natural law. But of course it isn't. It's a political system which inevitably alienates and is anti-intellectual and to my mind stills imagination.
And just to add to the point that Jess was making before as well about kind of like the different forms of labor, Yeah, Jess and I are both booksellers, and I think also kind of like doing that work and being in that sphere, you get such an insight into kind of like also the amount of work that goes into that role to actually kind of like keep pushing writers to get them to have that platform that will eventually kind of like result in sales or whatever. But if you don't actually kind of like, if writers and publishing houses don't communicate with those booksellers and with bookshops, then there isn't a sense of kind of like the flow of that labor as well. And just the amount of work that goes into it to actually kind of like make sure that those voices who eventually show up on stage are actually heard to begin with.
I'm conscious about time, and I wanted to like use the last sort of section of our interview to sort of talk about how you guys like sort of see what could improve about the book industry, like beyond all the sort of, you know, with this sort of in mind, like the sort of broader objectives, what would a sort of more equitable, what would a like a fairer, more diverse, and also just like more like a better functioning book industry look like? You know, do you have any thoughts on the ways in which we like indie publishers can be elevated? Is DIY publishing like one way of like looking into this? I think bearing in mind, Mohammed, what something you said about the ways in which like there are very few publishers who have sort of monopolized the industry, in ways that have sort of really affected how much compensation writers get, like the ways in which the pressures that like first-time authors or even like, you know, people who write certain kinds of novels, like literary fiction, for example, the pressures that they face. I wondered, like, as a very, very broad question, and so please interpret it as however you'd like what should we be working towards the book industry actually looking like, and how can organizations like Fossil-Free Books kind of facilitate the creation of a more equitable and also far more ethical like book industry?
Just to start by talking about the funding side of things. So one of the things that we've been encouraging festivals to do is to really look at their funding policies and to create ethical funding policies, because most of the festivals have them, but they're not really up to date when it comes to things like fossil fuel extraction, for example. And it's also about transparency, about doing like due diligence. Like lots of these festivals, I'm still fairly sure, did not know about a lot of these specific companies that Bailey Gifford were investing in, such as Petrobras, for example, in Brazil. And these are, you know, we can talk about emissions and we can talk about climate breakdown and in really vague terms. And that makes it possible for someone to say, oh, it's more important for me to have a lovely day out in the sun than to look at the actual destruction of a community. We are focusing on those communities. But the finance system, the way it is, actually requires people to take a huge amount of responsibility and to really do due diligence in terms of what are these investments. So that is a big part of the work. It's actually it's a form of finance education. It's about people knowing how the system works and how to navigate it, and to make sure that you then develop a funding policy that excludes these most harmful things. And there are organizations that have been doing amazing work on that already for years, like Culture Unstained, for example, on the art side.
Just to add to that as well, I think a huge point of Fossil-Free Books was that it gathered people from different parts of the book industry as well. So we do want to kind of like get more people on board to help out as well, because different people come with different expertise. And we didn't do all of the research and all of this work on our own as well. We also relied on research from Art Workers for Palestine Scotland, for example, who brought out a lot of the initial information about Bailey Gifford's investments in the Israeli occupation and apartheid and the tech industry there and tech and defense industry there. So yeah, I think it's just important to realize kind of like the amount that we can accomplish as workers when we actually kind of like gather together and realize that it is essentially our labor that upholds these institutions and allows them to kind of like carry on. But for that, we do need more capacity to actually make it also a sustainable thing, because we are doing this essentially during our free time, kind of like outside of our other bits of work, outside of writing. So we just always kind of like need more people to come and help out.
Yeah, I'd follow that up, I think, and I also just don't want to downplay what the demands are as sort of a person in the world, like for writers to really ask themselves really awkward questions, which all of us sort of have, I think, have been forced to collectively and then also just personally. You know, if the game currently is the only one in town, how should we relate to it? Should we be playing it? Mm. Should we be engaged through either our art or as a person away from the desk through social movements? But if we all agree that there needs to be some kind of preservation of the idea that art is intrinsically valuable as art itself, what formulations of that preservation can occur? But that really, you know, really does require of us some kind of soul searching. Mm. But the very notion, though, that it's a question that we are asking in a community of writers and book workers means that necessarily there may be other ways to relate to the world and the industry. Mm. And what those are and how we articulate those, I think, is a collective action. I suppose this, you know, can end on an invitation for people who are up for asking those awkward questions in a collective to come, because we do need you.
Mm. Great. Well, just as like a way to round this off before we close out, as you mentioned, like, you know, this is, you know, fossil free books kind of, it also sort of represents the need for authors and people who work in books and who people who work in publishing, I guess, more generally, to really be asking themselves like fairly important and like somewhat uncomfortable questions at times. And if people wanted to join your organization or if they were just interested to find out more, how could they do that?
So the first thing you could do is just get in touch with us, either through social media or fossilfreebooksuk@gmail.com. And then what we ask is for you to come along to one of our weekly meetings. And they are on Mondays at 12 o'clock, just to meet everyone, to hear what we're about, get a sense of what kind of things we're up to and where your skills might be most useful. And then after that, you're invited into our different group discussions and can get stuck in. But yeah, we're very keen on, you know, meeting everyone and continuing to build on that sense of trust, which has been really, really important. And actually, I would say vital over the last few months in just sustaining people during quite a difficult time.
Cool. Well, guys, thank you so much for coming on. Thank you so much for spending the hour with me. And thank you so much for like the work that you're doing as well. We'll put the link to Fossil Free Books in your show notes. We'll also put links to all the work, all your published work in the show notes as well if people want to read your books. And we'll also put a link to Guy's essay that we reference in this show. Please do read it. Please do share it, especially if you do work in publishing or something in publishing adjacent industry. And until next time, we'll catch you later. You know where to go, all the socials. We have Patreon, $5 a month, and it helps us to run the show and run it without ads and to sort of stay editorially independent. And it means that we can sort of host and do shows like this. You also get access to a cool Discord group too. Good community there where we talk about issues that we talk about on the show and also stuff that we don't talk about. So it's really, really good community there. Do check that out. This show is produced by Devon. Follow them at Devon_on Earth. Listen to Kill James Bond. And then final thing, we have links to Palestine. We have like GoFundMes and also links to Palestine aid organizations. Do consider donating, supporting if you can already. And as always, if there's a march or if there is a demonstration in your area, please do consider going to that. You know, there are networks that can support you. We'll put all the links into show notes as well in case you are interested in doing that and have some concerns about you know, security or just, you know, just general well-being. So yeah, do check those out and do continue supporting those organizations if you can. And until next time, we'll catch you later. Have a good one. Bye.